So good afternoon, everyone. I'm Brian Tramont. I'm the managing partner here at Wilkinson Barker Knauer and the chair of the Federal Society Communications Law Practice Group. It is my honor to welcome you all here today and to welcome Commissioner Wilson as well. We have an interview format, a fireside chat on tap for us today. And the interview will be conducted by Svetlana, a well-known friend in the bar and to the Federal Society, and a former FTC chief of staff who now works at NCTA. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Svetlana, and we will go from there.
Great. Thank you so much, Brian. And thank you to Wilkinson and the Federalist Society for hosting this amazing event. I'd also like to thank Nina, Tom Klotz of Commissioner Wilson's office, and Danielle at Wilkinson for all their assistance for today's event. So I have the pleasure of introducing Commissioner Christine Wilson of the Federal Trade Commission. She was sworn in on September 26, 2018. By President Donald Trump, and to a term that expires on September 25th, 2025. So it has a nice ring to that. Commissioner Wilson previously served as at the FTC as Chairman Muris's chief of staff during the George W. Bush administration and as a law clerk in the Bureau of Competition while attending Georgetown University Law Center. In between her periods of service at the FTC, Commissioner Wilson has practiced competition and consumer protection law at law firms and as in-house counsel. When nominated, Commissioner Wilson was serving as Senior Vice President, Legal, Regulatory, and International for Delta Airlines. Prior to joining Delta, Commissioner Wilson was a member of the Washington, D.C. Antitrust Practice Group of Kirkland & Ellis and O'Melveny & Myers. Earlier in her career, Commissioner Wilson worked with former Assistant Attorney General James F. Rill at Collier Shannon on a variety of competition law and policy initiatives, including the final report of the International Competition Advisory Committee commissioned by Attorney General Janet Reno. Commissioner Wilson graduated cum laude from Georgetown University Law Center, where she worked as a research assistant for Professor Steve Salop. She graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Florida, where she majored in political science and studied antitrust law with Professor Roger Blair. So thank you, Commissioner, for being with us today. We're privileged to have you. So as I mentioned in your bio, you've had a long career working in antitrust and consumer protection as an enforcer, a litigator, and more directly on regulatory policy. Can you tell us what has most surprised you about the commission today?
Sure. So I think one of the most surprising things is the bond that I share with my fellow commissioners. We come from very different points on the political spectrum, and we differ greatly in terms of ideology. But because we went through the nomination and confirmation process together, I think we have developed a bond that I think is unusual at the commission level. And so, yes, we differ significantly on approaches to various policy issues, but there's a robust and very respectful dialogue that happens one-on-one and then at commission meetings. And I think people would be surprised if they see the camaraderie behind the scenes.
So you've been, I guess this is your third stint at the FTC. Can you tell us what have been some of the biggest changes you've noticed at the agency since your last time there?
So I think one of the most significant changes is the vitriol and the polarization that we're seeing outside the agency. This is a very different feel than when I was serving as chief of staff to Tim Muris. The FTC retains respect on a bipartisan basis, which I think is good and healthy. And I think we are laboring to be thoughtful and careful about all of the ideas and suggestions that are floating around about how we should reshape consumer protection policy or antitrust policy. I think all of the questions that have been raised about the status quo and whether enforcement is occurring on an appropriate basis and at the appropriate level has prompted the FTC in a constructive way to return to its roots. When the FTC was created, it was with the intent of serving an R&D function, and it is very good at gathering information, pulling together reports, listening to different stakeholders, distilling all of that and moving forward on a policy basis after being informed by a broad set of views and perspectives. And so last summer, Chairman Simons launched the Competition and Consumer Protection Hearings in the 21st Century that I think have done a fantastic job of gathering all of those different perspectives and views and will allow us, again, to proceed in a thoughtful and measured way in an era of what is, outside the FTC walls, intense polarization.
Can you tell us how your time in private practice changed the way you view your role as an arbiter of antitrust enforcement and consumer protection enforcement at the FTC?
Sure. So I come to the practice of antitrust law with an intense dislike for command and control economies. If you saw any of my testimony during the confirmation hearings or looked at any piece of paper written about me, you would hear at a very early age, I took a trip through Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union in 1984 and saw the impact of command and control economy. And so I am very wary of overreach by the government and intervention unnecessarily. And so I think my experience both as a private outside counsel for firms and then even more particularly in-house at Delta Airlines has helped me understand in a more granular way the nature of the costs that are imposed. So think, for example, the direct costs that a company could experience if it were interested in pursuing a merger. The second request process can cost $3 to $5 million. If you are receiving a CID as a third party in someone else's merger, the costs can also rack up. If you are the subject or target of an investigation, the investigations can sometimes be quite wide-ranging and sprawling. They detract the attention of the senior management from the business at hand. And I'm not saying that the FTC and DOJ and other government agencies should not conduct investigations, but I think we should be wary of our broad power and authority, and we should use it in a way that extracts the information necessary to perform the analysis without sweeping too broadly information that isn't necessary to that analysis. There are also indirect costs that get imposed. I am very wary of rules and regulations that enhance compliance costs and add infrastructure to companies without necessarily boosting consumer benefits that significantly. I particularly saw this, you know, with all due respect to my fellow agency now, the Department of Transportation, when I was at Delta Airlines dealing with all of the consumer rules that were being formulated and issued. And perhaps marginal or no benefit in terms of consumer safety and satisfaction, but significant compliance costs. And so for that reason, I approach new rules and regulations with perhaps more skepticism than some of my colleagues. And so I dissented a couple of months ago in issuing the energy labeling guides. Obviously, we're mandated by statute to address the content of these energy labels that go on appliances, but it isn't necessary for us, and I would submit to you, it is not the Federal Trade Commission's comparative advantage to describe the weight of the paper that should be used in preparing the labels. For the record, it's 58 pounds per 500 sheets of paper. And I also don't think we have a comparative advantage in defining the minimum adhesive peel capacity. So I was hoping that we could get those provisions of the rules revisited before issuing them, and that did not happen, hence the dissent. And then yesterday, you may have seen that Commissioner Phillips and I dissented from issuance of proposed revisions to the safeguards rule, and we'll talk a little more about the impending changes that we may be seeing on the privacy and data security fronts. But in light of those impending changes, in light of the fact that the safeguards rule covers only a small fraction of industry, and in light of a number of other factors that you can read in our dissent, we felt that this probably wasn't quite the right time to pursue those revisions. So long-winded answer, but at bottom, measured, careful, narrow government.
We could all agree with that. So I wanted to touch upon an issue that is always in the headlines these days, which are robocalls. There's not a day that doesn't go by that we don't see something on robocalls. Can you tell us how the FTC and FCC are coordinating enforcement on robocalls? And are there anything we should be looking out for in the future about robocalls in terms of enforcement?
So you are right. It's intrusive, it's obnoxious, it's illegal. And as I was going through the confirmation process, robocalls was the topic that almost every single senator wanted to discuss. And it's the biggest source of complaints from their constituents, and it is the biggest source of complaints, as you well know, to the Federal Trade Commission. And so I've received briefings from the team in Lois Weissman's shop that deals with robocalls, and it is a very energetic group. We have worked very closely with the FCC on this issue. When I was Tim Muris's chief of staff back in 2001, 2002, I remember fondly the working relationship that Chairman Powell at the FCC had with Chairman Muris, and under their joint leadership and guidance, we were able to develop the Do Not Call list. And I see Dan Caprio nodding. Commissioner Swindle, for whom Dan worked at the time, was also a big supporter and ally of that effort. And so I think that the FTC and FCC partnership extends back a long time. The FCC has been working, as you know, on ways to authorize carriers to block what are likely deceptive or illegitimate calls. I joined Chairman Pai's call for swift implementation of Shake and Stir, and I think the sooner the better. There are lots of folks out there that are waiting for it. And the FTC continues to partner with the FCC in terms of hosting policy forums, helping to sponsor and to urge industry to come up with different technologies to combat the problem. We have routine calls with the FCC, but we also work with state AGs. We brought the Dish Network complaint with them, and also with our partners abroad through ICPEN and through other multinational organizations. And so it is an area of focus. We are working within the scope of our authority to address the issue and supporting the FCC and everything that it can do. Through the FTC's enforcement actions, here's a figure I like, we've gotten judgments of $1.5 billion imposed, although we've collected $121 million. So most of that's suspended, but we are out there and working on it.
And then FTC also does a lot of these tech challenges.
Yep.
And won several awards for that, and the Nomo Robo technology emanated from a challenge that the FTC facilitated, so that's great.
So we actually get a lot of robocalls on the FTC cells in my office, and I keep saying I need to put Nomo Robo on my phone. If I were more IT savvy, I would do that. Working on it.
Right. So you mentioned briefly the FTC's period of self-reflection and going through and talking to stakeholders as to whether changes in the economy should change the FTC's approach to enforcement and otherwise. So the FTC has had a set of hearings so far. What have you learned so far from the hearings, and have you learned anything unexpected?
It's a great question. It is a huge effort on the part of the FTC. Bilal Sayed, who's the head of our Office of Policy and Planning, has been spearheading that effort along with Sarah Mackey-Mathias. They've been doing a fantastic job of gathering folks from across the spectrum, lots of different perspectives. I think we've had over 200 panelists and more than 700 submissions, and so we are getting a very diverse array of views. I've been pleased with the level of submissions that we've been receiving, pleasantly surprised that folks are really taking a lot of care and time and attention in preparing submissions that, frankly, in areas that I'm not as familiar with, have allowed me to move up the learning curve more rapidly. And I look forward to hearing and enjoying the remaining hearings and then talking with my colleagues to distill that information and figure out whether any policy changes or course corrections need to be made going forward.
So I wanted to touch on mergers, and in particular vertical mergers. In your statement on the Ascendant Staples merger, you said that there were very few vertical mergers that should be challenged. Can you tell us the types of vertical mergers you find concerning in light of the consolidation happening today in media technology, for example? At the FTC, some witnesses had suggested that the DOJ and FTC should issue vertical merger guidelines, and it's second question is, what do you think about that idea?
Sure. So there was a three commissioner majority in Staples Ascendant. Two of the commissioners dissented. The Democrats, Becca Slaughter and Rohit Chopra, dissented. There was a majority opinion, and then I wrote separately to address vertical merger issues more broadly. Maybe Nini can grab my phone and mute it. And my apologies for not doing that before we began. So in terms of vertical mergers, to the extent there are anti-competitive vertical mergers, unfortunately, the answer is probably not very satisfying, that whether a merger is anti-competitive is very fact-specific, as is everything in the field of antitrust law. I did study with Professor Steve Salop when I was at Georgetown, and even Salop, who I think takes a very skeptical view of vertical mergers, would admit that there are very few vertical mergers that actually satisfy his different conditions for potentially producing any competitive effects. And so if you have high concentration oligopoly conditions upstream and downstream, it is possible that any competitive effects could arise, but it is also the concentrated markets that tend to produce the most elimination of double marginalization and that have the chance to produce the greatest efficiencies. And so again, in terms of what we would be looking for, it's very fact specific. In terms of how to decide, you look at whether the models and the investigational evidence dovetail, because the models themselves are more an art than a science. And so if the models are telling you one thing and the evidence is pointing in another direction, you need to look really closely. But if the models and the documents and the testimony are all lining up with the arrow pointing in the same direction, it's worth a closer look. In terms of whether we would be interested in issuing vertical merger guidelines, obviously I'm not the chairman, and I am not Assistant Attorney General Macon Dalrahim, and both of them have expressed an interest in considering whether to issue vertical merger guidelines. I would note that there are traditional rationales for whether to issue guidelines. One of the most important considerations is obviously to provide transparency and predictability to businesses. And so there are different reasons, different bases on which to do guidelines. You can distill existing law, you can hope to advance the law in a different direction, you can enshrine different modeling techniques or analytical techniques. And I think we need to be very careful about enshrining anything at this point, given the fact, as I said, that these models are, especially the ones that evaluate harm, much more art than science. And so if we were interested in I think, facilitating transparency for businesses, we may want to consider something like the commentary on the horizontal merger guidelines that was undertaken several years ago that explained the practices and the analysis that goes on behind the scenes and then uses previous cases as examples to show how of those different phenomena play out in practice. I am not yet convinced that new guidelines would be useful. But again, above my pay grade.
Okay. You recently gave a speech, I believe, at George Mason a few weeks ago where you discussed alternative welfare standards that could be applied in an antitrust analysis. Right now there seems to be a dialogue on whether the consumer welfare standard is the right standard to employ in antitrust cases. In your speech, you address some of the critiques of the consumer welfare standard, but also discuss several benefits of a total welfare standard. Can you explain what the total welfare standard is, and do you believe that agencies should adopt a total welfare standard?
Sure. So for those folks who are not antitrust lawyers by training, the welfare standard is what you measure to determine whether a given transaction or a given type of conduct is lawful or unlawful. The consumer welfare standard focuses on the impact of a transaction or a practice on consumers. Will price increase or decrease? And obviously, there are a lot of non-price factors that are considered as well. Price is shorthand for essentially gauging the impact of conduct or practice on consumers. A number of the welfare standards that have been advanced by those on the left would have us balance multiple goals or would look at a competitive process, which turns into essentially a public interest standard or protecting competitors rather than competition. And all of those are redistributive. It's not focusing on what's good for the consumer. It's also taking into account what's good for employees, for wages, for a number of other factors, which frankly lends itself to a lot of unpredictability and arbitrariness, and is ripe for political intervention and fingers on the scale. And so to balance that discussion, I threw out there that we should be talking about the total welfare standard as well. It's a nice foil to the redistributive interests of some of these other standards that have been introduced. And so in the total welfare standard, you only look at the impact of a deal or conduct to the economy. And so how the gains and losses are distributed as between producers and consumers is not part of the equation. The question is, on net, is it good for the economy? And so if we are looking to grow the economy, if we are looking, frankly, to what the FTC and DOJ have as their comparative advantage of evaluating transactions based on economics, then that would be a standard that would seem useful to employ. And that way, we could grow the size of the pie so that those who'd like to redistribute have a larger pie to distribute. But again, we are in a period of discussion and reflection, and I throw out the total welfare standard as a foil to those who think that redistribution is a good way to approach antitrust law.
She's up for the challenge, so let's see what happens. So I wanted to turn from antitrust to data protection. As you know, the EU's GDPR and the new California Privacy Act have altered the privacy landscape and the privacy discussion here in the United States. As part of these developments, many are calling for a federal baseline privacy law. What do you envision good privacy legislation would look like? So I'll give you that question, and I'll talk about FTC tools later.
Sure. So I think probably a lot of people in this room and a lot of people in Washington and across the country wouldn't have talked about good privacy legislation even a couple of years ago. But following GDPR and following California, folks have become very concerned about establishing a national baseline. I think that's a laudable goal. And in terms of what we should be looking for from privacy legislation, I think consumers who are informed can make choices that are in their own self-interest. And so I think transparency is a good thing. I think consumers at this point may not necessarily understand what is happening with their data. My favorite story is you tell consumers, true or false, if there's a privacy policy on a website, it means that that website doesn't share your data with a third party. A majority of Americans will say that that's a true statement. So I think some legislation that has the side effect of educating consumers, I think, would be very useful, providing transparency and predictability and certainty to businesses. So I think federal preemption is necessary. I think it is important within the scope of that legislation to repeal the common carrier exemption for the FTC and the nonprofit exemption. I think civil penalties under appropriate circumstances should be given to the FTC. And I believe that very narrow targeted APA rulemaking would be appropriate as well. So I think those are some of the things that I would be looking for in privacy legislation.
Okay. So you mentioned some of the proposals that we're seeing for privacy legislation. Some of them follow closely the GDPR obligations and concepts. For example, they would create accountability requirements and mandate privacy risk assessments. What are your thoughts on those types of approaches here in the United States?
So I think that GDPR obviously has a lot of the same phrases and concepts that the FTC has described as best practices in the past. So for example, transparency. data minimization, de-identification, risk management. And so there are things that sound very familiar to the US public and to policymakers here. But at the same time, I would caution that GDPR was enacted in a different environment. And so there are different goals that the EU has. I was reading an article recently that said that in Germany, there is a constitutional right to informational self-determination. I'm not sure what that means, but I don't think that we have that here in the United States. I think we prefer free speech and other rights. So there are some tensions in terms of importing GDPR wholesale. Also, there have been, one of my favorite themes, unintended consequences from GDPR. So if you look at the way its implementation has played out in practice, you see that, in fact, advertising has fallen, but the shares of Google and Facebook and some of the incumbent entrenched advertisers have actually seen growth in their shares. You've also seen the new entry fall, and you've seen investment in the space fall. And so given those actually probably foreseeable consequences, I think we need to be very careful about looking to adopt wholesale anything that GDPR would lay out for us.
And that's very timely because Senate Judiciary is having a hearing next week on GDPR's implications on the antitrust side in terms of entrenching of market incumbents and so forth. So it's very timely discussion.
Right. So privacy is important, data security is important, but so is competition.
Right. You were at in-house, and so can you talk about how we could best encourage practices that may lead companies to consider privacy issues in a more holistic way?
So I think that if consumers are informed about practices, they will vote with their feet and with their dollars. And I do think that given repeated articles and disclosures that we've seen about what's happening with data and information, consumers are becoming more aware. And in response, we are beginning to see changes that indicate perhaps, in some small way, we are moving toward that goal. So Apple now requires every app in its app store to have a privacy policy. Microsoft has just created a dashboard that explains the collection and use practices of its company. Apple is talking about minimizing the data that it collects and storing it on devices instead of in the cloud and de-identifying it. And so I think there is a move to respond to some of the press articles and consumer reaction that we've seen. And I think as consumers express their appreciation, voting with their feet and with their dollars, we will see more of that. Small steps, but important ones.
So one other issue that's being debated in the privacy legislation is sensitivity of data. Do you believe that data privacy protection should depend on how sensitive data is? And if that's the case, what do you think makes data sensitive?
Sure. So if I can use an example to hark back to, again, when Dan and I were at the Federal Trade Commission together, one of the first cases that was brought was against Eli Lilly. There was a website that Eli Lilly had implemented to remind Prozac users of when their prescriptions needed to be refilled and to disseminate other information. And inadvertently, when Eli Lilly was emailing everyone to say, we're taking the website down, they put all of the email addresses in the to instead of in the BCC field. So several hundred people, including many senior officials in the federal government, were suddenly aware of the fact that all of these other people around them were taking Prozac, which is, given the stigma that mental health in our country had then and that persists to some extent today, that was a reputational harm. And so that was one of the first cases that was brought under the Muris-Beals regime. And so I think it illustrates that, in fact, yes, there is sensitive data, and you think about health data, and we have HIPAA, financial data, we have GLBA, children. We have COPPA. And so there are categories of information that we would view as more sensitive given the vulnerabilities of certain types of information and the risk that could arise. And so I think we do absolutely need to keep that in mind. I think privacy is not monolithic. It is contextual, and we should remember that as we move forward discussing privacy legislation.
Makes sense. So we talked about some of additional tools you wanted to have in the privacy and data security space. Are there any additional authorities you would like to have in the consumer protection arena more generally?
So I think the key, and this is something that the FTC has been talking about for a while, repeal of the common carrier exemption would be key to being able to enforce laws systematically against all businesses that are in the same position. I think it's important to repeal the nonprofit exemption because there are breaches that occur, for example, with universities. And so not being able to address those situations is a problem. And so I think in terms of authority, those two would be at the top of our list. And then APA rulemaking authority on a narrow and targeted basis, hopefully, for both privacy and data security in the near future.
One other hot button issue on the Hill and elsewhere is net neutrality. Do you think the FTC has the resources and capability to enforce net neutrality?
Absolutely. So the diplomatic answer is that obviously this is, you know, the choice of Congress and the courts, and we will do whatever it is that we are authorized to do fully and to the full extent of our capabilities. But from a parochial perspective, the Federal Trade Commission has been dealing with these issues for years and years and years. And so on the antitrust side, we brought the AOL Time Warner case, we extracted a consent to protect competition in the ISP space. There are other mergers that have also touched on these issues where the FTC has either decided competition would not be harmed or would extract remedies. On the consumer protection side, we have gone after companies that have made deceptive claims about, for example, unlimited data. And in fact, when you reach a cap, data throttling kicks in. And so the FTC has been the cop on the beat for many, many, many years, and absolutely has the tools and capabilities to deal with this in the future. I think Maureen's submission to the FCC on the topic and staff's submission to the FCC on this topic did a fantastic job of laying out the skills and capabilities of the agency, and I fully agree.
So both with respect to net neutrality and privacy, there are a lot of state laws popping up that are trying to regulate in the area. Can you talk about your views of the upsides and downsides to a state-by-state regulation in this area?
Sure. So let me draw a distinction. With data security and breach notification, where you have different state laws that can be workable because breach is something that occurs hopefully on a one-off basis, but privacy is something that companies need to consider every day in every aspect of their business. And so I think it is going to be affirmatively counterproductive to business and to innovation and to economic growth if we see a patchwork of state laws developing. It's one of the reasons that I think we all see full support now for federal privacy legislation that would preempt the state legislation. You see this tension between a state's police powers and the internet, which is borderless and global. I think there's a role potentially for the Commerce Clause to kick in. And so I think we need to do at the federal level whatever we need to do in terms of enacting privacy legislation and obtaining preemption to prevent that patchwork of privacy legislation across the states from occurring.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be a compliance headache for a company like Delta
and
others who would have to comply
with it. Absolutely. And then I think we also need to consider interoperability with other countries, with other jurisdictions as well. So when we're working on privacy legislation, how will we interact with countries that have the GDPR. Obviously, Privacy Shield has just been re-upped and hopefully will continue running smoothly. But interoperability with other nations, given the borderless nature of the internet, is something important to keep in mind.
So I wanted to talk generally about just practicing before the FTC. And I love this question because I think it gives a lot of insight to working with FTC. From your perspective as a commissioner and an antitrust enforcer and a longtime practitioner and being in-house, what would you say are the best and worst practices when engaging with government officials during an investigation?
I will not be fully candid on this topic. I have been at the FTC only since September, about 6 months, and I have seen some conduct from outside counsel that would shock you. So I won't talk about that. In terms of best practices, look, the FTC staff is experienced, they are excellent, and so the first recommendation would be to engage with staff who are working on the matter at hand. I think if they have concerns, obviously it's a best practice to engage with them, to respond to those concerns. Don't put your head in the sand and hope that it goes away. It won't. Bring in the law, the facts, the data to show why the concerns may be unfounded. In terms of arguments and making arguments, put them out there to staff and let them be tested. It is not helpful to have arguments made for the first time at the commission level. I think it's important to observe the chain of command. It almost always works, not always, but almost always. And so if there's an issue with staff, take it to the head of the shop. If there's an issue that can't be addressed there, take it to the bureau. But work through that chain of command before calling a commissioner. Typically unnecessary to do that. And then allow yourself enough time, particularly if you're working on a deal, to have review at the bureau level and then at the commission level. There are processes that, given certain exigent circumstances, we may be able to expedite, but folks should not count on that. So those are some of the best practices and things to do. In terms of things to avoid, it does seem like this should go without saying, but don't be condescending or rude to the commissioners or to their staff. Don't badmouth the front office or the staff to the commissioners. Again, don't roll out arguments that haven't been made to staff. Springing new arguments at the commission level is just going to send you back to staff anyway. And so I would say those are the things not to do that we can talk about in polite conversation.
Got it. All right. So you were mentioning on the enforcement and investigation side. Do you have any advice for more on the policy advocacy side, what to do and what to avoid?
Oh, so I think this is a very inquisitive and energetic commission. I don't know if you've noticed, but we're all incredibly energetic and opinionated. And so we do have a lot of folks coming in and talking with us about policy issues and advocacy issues. And I love when people bring concerns, thoughts, ideas to me. A number of you in this room have been gracious enough to come in and share your views with me on privacy issues. It's an area that I was involved in with Tim and Do Not Call, but obviously a lot has happened in the interim, and I like to say I'm crawling up the learning curve again, and there have been a number of folks in this room, like Neil and Dan, who have been gracious with their time and giving me reading. In terms of advocacy, I would say, and this may not be the kind of advocacy you had in mind, but one of the most important missions of the Federal Trade Commission is competition advocacy, talking to other federal agencies and to state and local governments about the potential impact of policies that they would like to implement on competition and on consumers. And so I think, frankly, there's probably no more important role that the FTC can serve, because the barriers to entry that persist the longest are those that are implemented by the government. And so I've had folks come in and talk to me about competition advocacy possibilities, and I have been talking with Bilal Sayed behind the scenes about those. And if there are opportunities for the FTC to weigh in on pending policies or bills at the state level, even at the federal level, please do come and talk to us, because that's an area where I get really excited, and I think the FTC has an important role to play.
So on that point, as you know, Acting Chairman Olhausen developed the Economic Liberty Initiative. Is that something that you have in mind in terms of pursuing in terms of occupational licensing reform at the state level?
So I have huge respect for Maureen. I think she did a fantastic job with the Economic Liberty Task Force, and I would love to see that work continue. I've had conversations with staff about how we can be involved in continuing that effort. And again, I think that's an area where government intervenes in a way that really does harm livelihoods and inhibit competition. And so absolutely, I want to be involved in that and fully support the continuing efforts of the FTC on that front.
Sounds good. So we're coming to a close. I just have one more question, then we'll take audience questions if it's okay with you.
Sure.
You've been involved for a long time with the Grapevine, which is a women leadership group for antitrust and consumer protection attorneys. But there seems to be more female leadership in the public sector than in the private sector. Do you have any thoughts on how that could be changed?
So I did found the Grapevine, as you mentioned, and it was an opportunity for women in competition and consumer protection to network and to become aware of all of the different career paths that they could follow. I do think that it's incredibly important for all of us, not just for women, to reach down and give a hand to all of those in the generation coming up behind us. I tell this already to my daughter, who's a senior in high school, that she has a responsibility to the freshmen on her girls' basketball team to, you know, pull them up the learning curve. So I think it's incumbent on all of us to do that. And then to women, I would say, you have not because you ask not. I think there's a book with a title, something along those lines, that if you don't ask, you won't receive. If you ask, you may not get it, but throw your hat in the ring for leadership opportunities, take leadership training, and to the rest of us, look for the talent regardless of gender, skin color, et cetera.
Great. So with that, my Q&A is coming to a close, but I wanted to open it up to any audience questions.
It's Bob. My name is Bob Quinn. I'm with Wilkinson, and I recently retired from AT&T. I spent a long time doing regulatory work for AT&T, and your comments on net neutrality are very interesting to me. And I think a debate's going to come up, and I think we're going to see this in the legislation that comes out of the Democrats over today or tomorrow, whenever it's introduced. But I had a lot of questions and conversations with our friends in the tech industry who support net neutrality legislation. And one of the pieces from the FCC order that group would like to see in a piece of legislation was something that is affectionately referred to in my industry as the general conduct rule. And my response to those folks was that we had a general conduct rule that everybody lives with. It's called Section 5. It's the unfair trade practices part of the unfair and deceptive trade practices language in the statute. And I would always pose to them why that would not serve as the general conduct standard for anti-competitive acts taken from a competition influencing perspective, which is what they're very concerned about. And they always came back to me to tell me that either by choice or by rule, that standard was not appropriate to police anti-competitive actions where carriers were violating the principles of net neutrality from a competitive perspective. And I'd like your thoughts on that, because I never thought that there was a whole lot to that argument, but I heard it a lot.
So the short answer is that I agree. I think the FTC has done well with its Section 5 authority in this and in other areas, both on the competition and consumer protection sides. And I'm not sure what a general conduct rule at another agency would add.
Hi, I want to ask a couple of questions on the competition side. So as you know, there's a lot more discussion about the FTC paying a lot more attention to the tech industry on the competition side. And there have been discussions about whether your agency should use your authority more, including to look at mergers that have already been consummated. And of course, there was the recent task force that was announced. So just want to hear your thought, your take on all of that. And also with respect to drug competition, wanted to know, there's been some increased cooperation with the FDA, particularly with Scott Gottlieb under his leadership at the FDA. And so now that he's resigning, just wanted to know your take on the outlook for that going forward.
Sure. So on the first question, Chairman Simons, as you know, earlier this week, announced the formation of the Tech Task Force. A little bit of history: when Chairman Mieris and Bureau Director Simons were there previously, they saw a string of defeats in hospital mergers and decided it was important to create a task force to conduct retrospectives to figure out why both DOJ and the FTC were losing these hospital merger challenges time after time after time. And so the Hospital Merger Task Force was formed, conducted retrospectives, and some actions, enforcement actions, came out of that, for example, Evanston. And I think it is this model that Chairman Simons has in mind with the launch of the Tech Task Force. Obviously, there are lots of questions these days about some of our larger tech companies, whether they are too large, whether they are behaving in a way that violates the antitrust laws. I would tell you that big is not bad, that we need to have some form of anti-competitive conduct before the FTC or DOJ can actually exercise jurisdiction. But I look forward to the work of the Tech Task Force. We are going to have some of our most energetic and brightest attorneys working on that and exploring the issues that you see in the newspapers and that are coming out of the conversations that we're having at our competition hearings. On the cooperation with the FDA, again, as I mentioned, I think that some of the most important work that the FTC does is partnering with other federal agencies to talk about how competition can be the touchstone. We do have a very good relationship with the FDA. We work with them on many levels and across a variety of issues, and I don't anticipate that that will change in any way. Obviously, rising drug prices are a concern. We want to be sure that conduct in the marketplace is not contributing unlawfully to increased drug prices or healthcare costs more generally. And so that dialogue and that cooperation between the FTC and FDA will continue in a robust way.
And any other questions? So if you could please join me in thanking the commissioner for a wonderful interview.